Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's public media. Main Street Republicans in Bloomington Normal say they look ahead to a Biden administration with ambivalence. WGLT talked to members of the GOP who are not office holders, not involved in political activity, but say they do share the traditional values of the party. These are what used to be called business Republicans in an era that was less polarized than the country is today. They largely voted for Trump and support some of his policies. They're pro-business, anti-regulation, and think government should have limits. They say they view the coming Biden presidency with a mix of fear and optimism. Bloomington Normal banker Dave Rutledge says he has misgivings about the effect on the country if the policy plans of Biden come to pass.
Taxes, to me, is a big one, with the, you know, the country coming through the pandemic and so many businesses suffering. Some of the environmental policies and things like that will just put an extreme burden on businesses that they can't achieve. This waiving of, you know, student debt or free health care. No one's ever asked him how he's going to pay for it.
Attorney Craig Queen voted for Trump 4 years ago, but not this year. He says he was very disappointed in Trump's abandonment of traditional GOP values of fiscal responsibility, free trade, and a strong foreign policy that tries to contain Russia. Queen says he has some anxiety about Biden tax policy, but is willing to take him at his word for now that changes won't affect the vast majority of Americans. Retired attorney Bill Mueller says he hopes Biden will not be captured by the left that helped elect him.
I think he needs to think strongly about, you know, helping small businesses and really think very carefully about increasing any government regulation as to what is this regulation really addressed to do? What, you know, harm is it correcting? How serious is it? Whether he'll do that or not, I don't know.
Even though the popular vote went to Biden by a significant amount, President Trump received more votes than Barack Obama did in his two presidential contests. In fact, more votes than any U.S. candidate has ever received except for Biden. Banker Dave Rutledge says that should matter to both sides of the political divide.
I think it should be a message to all of the Democrats, but I don't think it matters to them. To me, the problem with politics has become it's all about money and power and control and not about what's best for the people.
Retired lawyer Bill Mueller says he has no deep worry about policy in a Biden presidency. He says he thinks Biden realizes he has to govern from the center because most tickets get split, and that will continue to happen.
You know, the best example of that is probably right in Illinois, where Biden won overwhelmingly, but the so-called fair tax referendum didn't come close to passing, didn't even get a majority.
Mueller says in other states, people voted handily for Trump, yet also approved a hike in the minimum wage. National rhetoric, though, has not matched that silent middle Mueller feels is an actual majority. And that's a barrier to getting compromise in the House and Senate. Mueller says Biden hit the right notes after the election, saying he wouldn't be a Democrat or Republican president, but an American president. And yet,
he said that we have to stop demonizing people who disagree with us. Well, that lasted about a day because the next day he, you know, refers to Trump as an embarrassment to the country and to the traditions of the country because he wouldn't concede the election. And it's continued.
Craig Queen says he has hope of a more centrist approach.
I think his political collateral is sufficient. I also think that Joe Biden, having sat in the Senate for as long as he has, will be able to work with what I anticipate will probably be a Republican Senate in issues.
Queen says he suspects Biden will be able to work with GOP Senate leader Mitch McConnell in a constructive way on some issues. Queen says the Republican gains in the House will also help force Biden to the center.
I really am looking forward to hopefully a balanced government.
Dave Rutledge is not so optimistic that there remains a class of national political leader that views the art of the deal, to borrow a phrase, as a crucial part of government.
Honestly, I don't think so anymore. We have become such a divided nation of extremes. I mean, it's, you know, at some point you had a group of Republicans and Democrats that kind of had a more moderate view and opinion. And I think since the last administration, it has become further and further of a divide, and that overlapping group has become smaller and smaller.
Rutledge says the vitriol of the language in the last election means it will take someone with extreme skills to bring lawmakers back together. The Main Street Republicans interviewed for this story say Biden is not the only piece of the political puzzle that has to tack to the center. Lawyer Craig Queen says the GOP must also seek a way back to bipartisanship.
I think they need to move back where they've been most of my life, which is more to the moderate side. You know, as much as the Democratic Party has shifted to the left, the Republican Party has shifted to the right.
Queen says both parties need to understand the nation has a lot more people like him than it does in the fringe groups. But here is where Queen says his optimism runs into reality.
I'm hopeful that Donald Trump and his base will end up in rather obscurity going forward. I'm afraid he and that movement will carry some momentum for a while.
Possibly the best service Biden can render the country, Bill Mueller says, is to settle everybody down. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas. During the first 3 months of the pandemic, the number of Americans dying not just from COVID-19 increased compared to previous years. That's according to a recent study led by University of Illinois researchers involving CDC data. Christine Herman speaks with internal medicine professor Dr. Janet Jokola and computer scientist Sheldon Jacobson about what they find and what questions remain.
So between mid-August and the week before Thanksgiving, that comprises the in-person portion of the semester, about 80% of all cases occurred among undergrads. So of those cases, about a third were among undergraduate students living in private certified housing. So that includes Greek houses, even though they made up only about 13% of undergrads tested. So a rough calculation on the data provided by the university shows that overall, about 1 in 10 undergrads on campus tested positive this semester. But among students living in frats, sororities, and other certified housing, the rate appears significantly higher, about 1 in 3. So before we move on, I do need to include a caveat about this data. The university could only provide us the total number of students testing in each living situation at the beginning and end of the in-person semester. They say this is because students' living situations fluctuated. You know, some went home, some came back to campus between mid-August and late November. So when I say about 1 in 3 students living in Greek and other private certified housing tested positive for COVID, that's an estimate based on the number of those students getting tested at the beginning of the semester. So even though these are estimates, campus officials still acknowledge that students living in Greek houses and other private certified housing represent a disproportionate number of positive cases, and that's compared to students in other living circumstances.
Gotcha. What about those students in other circumstances, like those in dorms and off campus?
So 15% of all undergraduate infection, or about 483 cases, were among students living in university housing. So that's dorms. And about half of all undergrad cases occurred among those living off campus. But that's to be expected because they also made up about 65% of undergrads tested.
And what do campus officials have to say about why rates were so much higher among students in Greek and other certified housing?
So U of I spokeswoman Robin Kaler told me in an email that that's likely due to the fact that you're combining a congregate living setting with the social nature of these organizations. And I'm sure you remember that early on in the semester, there were some students hosting or attending parties while knowingly infected with COVID-19. And this caused several super spreader events that led to huge spike in cases earlier on. And it also led to campus having to implement some temporary restrictions on all non-essential activities.
And what do officials say they're going to do going forward to reduce COVID transmission among some of the groups where they saw the most spread?
Yeah, so I think it's first important to note that when students come back in January, we're going to be in the middle of this second wave of the pandemic. and there will likely be higher rates of community transmission than when they returned back to campus this past August. So officials say that they're working with some of their own social scientists now to better understand how students make decisions and understand their risk-taking behavior. They're also planning to refine the campus's testing, educational efforts, and other aspects of their response to COVID. The other big change for the spring semester is classes will be starting a week later than normal, but students are still being asked to arrive back on campus a week before classes start so that they can quarantine until they've received two negative tests. So the big takeaway here is that there's an expected spike that will occur, but campus officials are hopeful that they can clamp down on it before there's a major spread.
That's Dr. Janet Jokola and Professor Sheldon Jacobson at the University of Illinois in Urbana. They spoke with Christine Herman. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. There's another place to ask for relief from damage caused by the pandemic. Student reporter Donisha Mitchell has more.
The John M. Scott Commission has announced a $485,000 wellness grant for health service agencies. The funds help agencies meet the various health and wellness needs of the community. Chair of Commission Holly Ambule says this year's grants is crucial for agencies in the midst of the financial burdens of the pandemic.
This year, fortunately, there's more available. Of all the increased needs in the community, we're happy that there's more available.
Funds are up from last fiscal year to tackle health disparities in the community highlighted by COVID-19.
We have a firm expectation that all applicants will specifically target disparities when they write a proposal.
Ambule says she discovered that people of color and low-income residents were the first to get COVID-19 and likely to die from it. She says they're asking applicants to pay close attention to local data to see where these health disparities exist.
The reasons for that are complex. It's not their fault, and we understand that. And so we want to target the core root problems that are driving those kinds of trends.
Ambule says the grant is also crucial for nonprofit organizations that have struggled to receive financial assistance throughout the year.
Nonprofits are important employers, an important part of the economy. They also deliver really important services across the lifespan to all kinds of people.
The deadline for the application is December 31st on the City of Bloomington website.
Holly Ambule says the John M. Scott Grant Health Program is one of the larger opportunities in the community. If you watched episode 9 of Fargo, you will recall it was in black and white until the very end, at which point you may have recognized a historical Italianate farmhouse in central Illinois. Katrina Peterson reports.
The Duncan Manor Mansion near Towanda on Towanda Barnes acted as a boarding house run by two sisters that didn't get along.
Come on, I'll give you the tour. This is the sitting room for board games and conversating.
What's with the line every place?
Well, now, the sisters, they ain't got along since the Dust Bowl days, but neither will renounce their claim to the premises. So I ask y'all questions and give me your answers. You either go west or east.
Fargo FX Productions filmed at the mansion for about 4 days. You can see two of the rooms in the episode. The first is the parlor, which acted as a lobby and check-in. The second room is the living room, used as a place for guests to just relax. All of the walls were papered in two different styles, split down the middle, as well as the furniture and rugs. Duncan Manor owner Dave Howell says he got to see the set come to life.
As far as kind of the house goes, it was pretty interesting. They did a lot of prep work. Basically, we were out of the house for about 3 weeks while they redid everything and got it to their standards. And then I think they filmed for about 4 days, and then they took about another week to kind of put it back to normal or the condition we had it.
In fact, more of the show was shot in central Illinois. Pontiac and Flanagan were filming locations last season as well. Pontiac Mayor Bill Alvey says about 150 casts and crew stayed in Pontiac hotels. Filming in Pontiac took place on Mill Street, primarily in the 300 block. Duncan Manor owner Howell says a bus of about 30 unloaded at Duncan Manor Mansion to film in Towanda.
They partnered with a production company out of Chicago, and we just had, there was a location scout that approached us. So she approached us, and anyway, kind of went from there, so it's kind of interesting. They were looking for a scene you know, kind of a boarding house in the middle of nowhere in Kansas. So this kind of fit what they needed. It was close enough, I think, to the Chicago area where all those guys, they have all their sets and everything up there as well. So, yeah, they just kind of approached us, and we kind of worked back and forth.
Duncan Manor dates to the 1860s. In 1864, William Duncan bought 300 acres outside of Towanda, Illinois, and called this land Towanda Meadows. He was a cattle baron. Nearly 150 years later, the Howell family moved in July 6, 2014. Also in 2014, the Fargo series premiered its first season. Fargo is an American anthology black comedy crime drama television series primarily written by Noah Hawley. This is the first time Duncan Manor was used for filming, and in the future, Howell says they would be open to discussing more productions being filmed there.
You know, it is our home and we do live in it, so we're kind of, it'd have to be the right situation and people. These guys were super professional with everything. They left it better than they found it, so to speak. You know, they, anything that they, so they actually came in, we had wallpaper up on certain walls, and they actually removed the wallpaper we had and put up the stuff that they wanted and then took their stuff down and then put ours back up. Different walls, if they painted them, they said, hey, what color would you guys like these? So, I mean, they really catered and took care of us well on that end, which was really nice because there's a lot of work still yet to be done on the house.
When the Howell family first moved in, the manor had no electricity, plumbing, water, or HVAC. The roof was leaking, walls were crumbling, and porches rotting. They are renovating to open the mansion to the public. Howell says he hopes the mansion will host events like weddings next year.
We're in the process right now of trying to put in some ADA accessible restrooms outside so we can actually be open to the public more on a regular basis up here.
Duncan Manor has passed through many hands, but for the majority of its existence, it has acted as a rental property. I'm Katrina Peterson.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Illinois Innocence Project, based at the University of Illinois at Springfield, tomorrow will host Amanda Knox at a virtual event to benefit the organization. Knox was finally exonerated after her wrongful conviction and four-year imprisonment for the murder of her roommate while studying abroad in Italy in 2007. In the 9 years since she was freed on appeal, Knox wrote a best-selling memoir and became a journalist focused on criminal justice. Her book and other work has exposed elements of the criminal justice system, including false confessions, DNA evidence manipulation, and unequal access to justice in general. Hannah Meisel speaks with Knox about, among other things, race and the courts.
Yes, I don't look like, and I don't have the background of most of the people who are wrongfully convicted and swept under the rug by the criminal justice system. What is true is that was in Italy, I was the other. So there was a lot of prejudice that I ended up facing inside the courtroom. The truth of the matter is that, like, when you are accused of a crime, people can find ways to be prejudiced against you. And what happens is people feel comfortable being prejudiced against you in ways that they wouldn't otherwise, simply because you have been accused of a crime. That is what we see over and over again here in the United States, where it's young men of color most often. And like, how do you present your individual story when there is this overwhelming story that we've all internalized leading up to this one person who's on trial?
You know, here in Illinois in the 1970s and 80s in Chicago, we had a police commander, John Burge, and he oversaw the coerced confession by torture of more than 200 men who, you know, would later turn out to be innocent. The city of Chicago is still paying out, you know, settlements to those families. You experienced this in a different way. You weren't physically tortured, but you were days on end with very little sleep. You did not know the language. What does that tell you about just the power dynamic that exists when someone is accused?
I was not beaten. I was slapped. But regardless, you do not need to be having your fingernails torn out to be psychologically manipulated, question everything you know to be true, and to go along with whatever narrative the police are putting in front of you. There are a million ways that any reasonable human being would sign statements or start to think that they must be crazy because they are being told, they are being treated the way that they are by these authority figures that we entrust with our justice system. The impact that those people have in those positions is tremendous. And for people who are young, for people who are foreign or don't speak the language, you are particularly vulnerable to that kind of manipulation.
In the era of COVID-19, we have seen explosions of outbreaks in congregate facilities, including prisons. And I'm wondering, you know, when the pandemic hit Italy especially hard in the spring, you know, if you were thinking of those women in the jail and the prison that, you know, you lived with, or women who are like them.
I was able to survive prison and maintain the sanity that I have today, largely because I was able to have visitations from my family members. If this pandemic had happened while I was in prison still and I was unable to see my family, I don't know what I would do.
That's Amanda Knox in conversation with Hannah Meisel. Knox will headline a virtual event for the Illinois Innocence Project tomorrow. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.